Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Limitless. This is The Limitless, the podcast in between. You are now listening. You can walk an island way and you work all the rolling dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I came walking a long way just for another chap. Then I saw her in the crowd and I looked her in the eyes. Morning.
Morning, Alex.
How are you?
Hi. Yeah, I got through. I had to get past your blocker.
What blocker?
You have a blocker for cold calls, I guess it must be.
What did it say?
It said the number that you're trying to call does not accept unidentified telephone numbers or something like that. If you are a solicitor, please go away.
A solicitor or a barrister.
Yeah.
Huh. Maybe it's something to do with foreign, or maybe it's the NSA have got their wires crossed.
Well, here I am anyway. There's a lot of weird sound effects in the background.
Oh, sorry, there's a bit of sound effects of me starting the fire here. I'm just getting the fire going in the
in the
wood stove here.
Well, I think I had a glimpse of your wood life on a couple of videos that you have on YouTube. You and
yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's the little hut that I work out of, and so that's where I am now.
Mm-hmm. You and the dogs, is it?
Yeah, I got the dog in here too. Yeah,
it's nice.
It's cold. We had snow, so it's just it's all kind of winter wonderland outside, which is very lovely.
Hmm. So do you need a minute or?
Nope. Here I am.
Okay. All right. So we're recording.
Okay. If you hear sound effects in the background, this adds to the beautiful texture of the overall experience.
Yeah. What is it? Diegetic sound.
Diegetic. That's that word.
I just
that
found
word,
out.
Yeah.
I just found out listening to an interview you were giving. So.
Well, that the director of Field in England knows what diegetic means, but I guess I was too old to know what it meant. You know?
That was the interview, yeah. Well, I guess I'm too old too. It seemed like a largely redundant word, one of those words that
it's academic, just, it's academic to use. You know, yeah. So it sounds better than, you know, it doesn't sound so crude.
Yeah, to spread confusion.
Yeah, exactly. Academics have to have their own language.
Yeah.
Understand, because that makes them essential.
Yeah, absolutely. So before we get into that, because that's a whole can of worms, if we do, do you know that you went to the same college in Oxford as my grandfather?
Oh, really? Worcester?
Yeah, Worcester.
Yeah. What did he study there?
I can look, but we're talking back in 1920, so it's a long time before your time.
Yeah, I don't think I knew him.
Well, you know how I found out? It's because I've been looking into my grandfather's, my family history, and specifically my grandfather, so I was curious about Worcester College. And they have a list of alumni on the internet, and your name is right underneath his. Because his name...
Oh, how funny.
Yeah, his name
is
Alec.
What was his name?
Alec Horsley, so I guess they list it alphabetically by first name. So yeah, I'm curious. I mean, you didn't stay at Oxford, is that right?
Well, I was there for 3 years.
Oh, you did stick it through.
I was an undergraduate there, and then I was back there years later. I was an artist in residence at St. John's College, which is another college.
Right.
A little bit up the street.
Hmm.
So I've actually been there twice. I was there as an undergraduate, and then I was there again as a sort of a guest lecturer.
Right. Because, I mean, it's not something I would have ever guessed that you went to Oxford, right?
Well, I mean, it's... Why not?
Well, because you're the guy who made Repo.
It's interesting, though, isn't it? Because it was... When I went there, it was free, you know, because it was back in those days when university education was didn't cost anything. So, I mean, I assumed that I was going to, you know, if I went to university, I was going to go to somewhere like Kiel, you know. And no offense to Kiel. But, and then somehow I got to go for an interview at Oxford, and I'm just like, man, it's incredible. You know, it's all so quaint and picturesque, and I like it. Because right. If you grow up in an environment entirely of international brutalism, you know, and then you sort of see things that were made in the 17th century, you know, or before, you know, it's quite different.
Hmm. And did you have any experience of the hazing rituals and secret societies and stuff at Oxford?
I don't think there was any of that. I mean, I think that if you came from like a private school,
yeah.
if you were like Tony Blair or David Cameron,
yeah.
then probably you would have been a part of that world, you know, and forced to like put your dick in a pig's head and stuff.
Right.
But they were, even when I was there, those kind of toffs, you know, or guys from, I suppose, like Blair, like kind of mediocre, second-rate private school boys. There were a lot of them, but your real toffs, your Camerons, there were very few of them.
Mm.
I mean, because the thing was, even those days, they were struggling a bit. The public school boys were struggling a bit because of the influx of kids from state schools. Probably now that they have to pay so much more, I imagine it may have gone the other way again. There might be fewer people from state schools going to those kind of prestige universities now.
Right. So your experience wasn't remarkable in that way. And I mean, in any kind of, you didn't get a glimpse into the workings of the aristocracy.
No. Well, what was marvelous was I realized that they were just completely stupid. And that's the best thing of all, because my wife went to a convent school in San Francisco, which was like full of like really wealthy girls. And what you realize when you're put in an environment of the oligarchy is that they're just as stupid as anybody else.
Sure.
They have no special gifts. In fact, they're kind of disabled
yeah.
by their wealth and privilege.
Yeah.
And so that was like terribly empowering, to meet these doofuses, to meet people from like really wealthy backgrounds, and to realize how stupid they were, you know. So that was fun, and that was very empowering and good.
Okay. So how did you go from Oxford to LA Film School and then Repo Man? I mean, was that a smooth or was that a rocky ride? Or?
No, I went to Bristol. I went to film school in Bristol
mm-hmm.
because at the time, because this was, you know, years ago, very many film schools. In fact, I think there were only three film schools. Two of them were in London, the National and the London International, and one was in Bristol. And I didn't want to go to London, so that left Bristol.
Right.
So I applied to go to Bristol, and I got into this program at Bristol that was a course in radio, film, and television studies, as it was then known. I'm sure it's called media studies now. And I got like a certificate in that, and on the basis of that, I got a Fulbright grant, and I went to the U.S., and I got accepted at two universities in the U.S. to study film. One was UCLA, and one was Northwestern in Chicago. And I thought I would go to UCLA because it would be warmer.
Because mm-hmm.
I had the impression that Chicago would be very cold.
Right. And then, how many...
And so that was it. So I was at UCLA. I was at graduate school at UCLA for 2 or 3 years. I met a bunch of people there who were like other filmmakers, you know, just starting out on their trek. And two of those guys had started a production company. After they got out, they graduated the year ahead of me, and then I proposed to them that since they were already in production, they should be feature film producers. And I wrote Repo Man, the script for them.
So was one of them the Michael Nesmith, the monkey?
No, Michael Nesmith was the executive producer of the film. So he's considerably older than us. I mean, he's and he was the guy who went and found the money.
Right. And how old were you when you were shooting Repo Man then?
29.
Oh, so not such a spring chicken to be working with Harry Dean Stanton.
Harry Dean was 58, and I was 29.
Oh, so he's twenty double your age.
So he was exactly double my age, and I was making this film in Colorado. When we started building Galactic Hero, I was 58, and my assistant director was 29. And I said to him, "You know, you and I are in exactly the same situation as I was with Harry Dean Stanton. Be glad I don't treat you the way he treated me."
Okay.
I would just wind this guy up on a daily basis by telling him Harry Dean Stanton stories.
Right. Well, I'd be interested to get into that. Before I do, do you know anything about astrology?
Not really, no.
Because 29 is Saturn return. So that's when Saturn comes back to the position in your chart that it was when you were born, or the position in the sky that it was when you were born. And then, so 58 is your second Saturn return. So it's a very, you know, in astrology, it's a very key time. Both. You know, the return and the second return, and Saturn is.
And Harry might have known some of that stuff. You know, it's possible because he was all into kind of. He was more into kind of Eastern mysticism, though. I think he was more into that kind of Tibetan Buddhist stuff that a lot of the Hollywood people like.
Right.
But he might have. He might have been. I wonder if he was into that.
Was he? Was there a anything of a like a father son relationship that was going on with you and Harry?
Boy, I wouldn't like to have a father like that very much. So I'd be messed up. No, not at all. Like a well, in reverse, yeah, parent-child relationships in reverse. If the parent is 29 and the child is 58, sure. Because Harry was very unhappy, very disgruntled, very angry. Didn't really help that he would go up to Jack Nicholson's house on the weekend and do loads of cocaine and alcohol and get totally drunk. And then come to work in a foul mood on Monday morning, you know. He was, like, totally indisciplined, really an unpleasant guy, but a great actor.
Yeah. Well, I just rewatched Repo Man, and I was struck by Harry Dean's character and how it seemed to sort of emerged from Harry Dean himself. I was thinking, how much was this character written? Not in the sense that he was improvising necessarily, but I mean, there wasn't much character on the page, really. There was a few lines here and there, but the character was so strong, and I just wondered how much of that was actually coming.
Well, no, but he had a lot of very, very specific dialogue. He has the best dialogue in the movie. I mean, all the best lines are his. So, I mean, the character's very clear on the page. I think the difference was that what Harry did in terms of that repo code thing was Harry consolidated a number of lines that were kind of from separate scenes into that one speech. You know, he wanted to make the repo code a bit bigger and make that scene a bit more significant. And so he consolidated some of his lines from elsewhere in the script, but he's not really an improviser. I don't think he improvised anything.
Yeah, no, I didn't really mean that. I didn't get that sense, but just somehow that he seemed to fit so well with that character that you'd written.
Just perfect, isn't he? I mean, it's hard to imagine anybody doing it better. I mean, he did it. He was just right in it.
Yeah. So was it intimidating for you, to, even at 29, to be suddenly in kind of that at that level of celebrity interaction and that level of responsibility?
Well, no, because Harry wasn't a celebrity. I mean, I was one of the only people who even knew who he was. I mean, Harry was like Harry was a supporting actor in lower budget Hollywood films and Corman movies. I mean, he wasn't a big star. And when I went meet his agent, which I kind of did as a courtesy, you know, just to say hello, I'm very pleased to be working with your client, the guy said to me, "What do you want to work with Harry Dean for? He's past it. I can get you a much better actor."
Right.
And I said, "You're kidding. No, I mean, what do you mean?" He goes, Mick Jagger. Perfect for the role. I represent Mick, too. I'm thinking, wow, this is really interesting. how people in Hollywood get screwed by their own agents.
Yeah.
Of course, not only in Hollywood, they do it in London,
yeah,
too. But it was interesting to go to meet Harry's agent and have the agent try and get the job, try and lose him the job.
Right.
You know, and I didn't tell Harry that.
I was going to say,
put him in a fury. And
So Reaper Man very much put you on the map, as they say. I think it was the timing of Reaper Man was interesting. I wrote about it in Blood Poets, that it seemed to be a like a prototypical movie. There was a certain flavour to it that really anticipated a style in independent film that I think you can trace back to Repo Man.
Well, it came out of the punk thing, didn't it? It and Penny Spears' film Suburbia made around about the same time, and maybe they were both kind of early examples of what a punk cinema might have been like.
Mm. Yeah. So were you a punk when you made it?
I was into the movement. I mean, I was a little bit older than the demographic of the punk movement, but I was definitely in favour of it. I thought it was a splendid thing. Totally into it.
Right. And did making Sid and Nancy and getting deeper into that world, did that change your view much of the whole thing?
Well, I may be less interested in the punk thing in the end, because by then I'd like done two punk films, and that was probably enough punk films, you know. But it was interesting. I mean, it was an interesting experience.
Mm-hmm.
It made me appreciate a lot more what McFarlane must have had on his hands as he tried to, you know, be a band manager.
Yeah, well, that's what I was thinking about, was that, because I grew up with punk, kind of, my brother was into it, and so I was around it, like he had the God Save the Queen poster hanging out of his window when the Queen came by, and he was right there
on
the cusp of that in 77.
Where were you guys growing up?
In Beverley, in Yorkshire.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, are you Sebastian's brother?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, great.
Oh, okay.
So that, now it all makes sense. I know, of course, because your name is Horsley. Of course, you're Sebastian's brother.
Right. Did you know Sebastian, or people who know him?
You know, this is really weird, because I didn't know him, but not long before he died, when that play was coming out, Stephen Fry's company got in touch with me, and they had optioned the rights to his book.
Yeah.
And I read the book. I thought the book was fucking great. You know? Because I didn't know really about him, because I'd never been part of the scene. And so I thought maybe he was just kind of a bit of a poser or something. But the book is so good and so funny and so self-aware and ironic. I just thought it'd be a marvelous film, you know. I see all these scenes of, like, you guys as little as children and stuff in this up north, and everybody's got a dark black cloud over their head, literally, as they're walking down the street, you know. And,
mm-hmm.
and it was just such a good, it would have made such a good film, an antidote to the kind of the quality English movies, you know, the rom-coms. And so I just thought it would be a great project, and I talked to him and exchanged notes about the project, and then he went and did that stupid thing, you know. And
what stupid thing? Oh, my brother, you mean? Oh, okay, I thought you were talking about Stephen Fry. So you mean you talked to Sebastian?
Yeah.
Oh.
About doing it, about doing the film. We had a good conversation about about what the film would be like and what kind of shape it would take, and how his experiences with John Lydon, because he really rated John Lydon, but John Lydon would always just be rude to him and sing that Steve Harley song, you know.
Which actually, this is all new to me. I mean, I know that my brother was crazy about John Lydon, but I didn't know.
He loved John Lydon, and the thing was, Lydon was like really mean to him, you know, and so whenever he would get together with, or he'd be in the same room as Lydon,
yeah,
Lydon would sing, there's a Steve Harley Cockney Rebel song called Sebastian.
Oh, yeah, yeah, of course.
And so every time Johnny Rotten ran into Sebastian Horsley, he would go, somebody called me Sebastian. You know, he'd sing the whole song, which actually is not a bad kind of weirdo, kind of psychedelic song, but it was obviously very annoying.
Yeah.
Oh, anyway, so I just had some nice conversations with him about that, and I was, yeah. I'm just sorry how it all shook out.
Yeah. Gosh, well, that's unexpected. I had no idea.
How about that? Yeah, isn't that interesting?
It is. I mean, a lot of things are coming together here now, because I mentioned right away that my grandfather and that weird overlap, and that's the reason I've been looking into my family history and my grandfather, is because of what happened to Sebastian.
And I've actually seen somebody else, by coincidence, pointed me towards some stuff that you had on the web. So I've actually, separately from this, not realizing it was you, I've actually read some of that stuff up there. The paedophile rings and the weirdness of the North, and not just the North.
Right.
It's all very interesting.
No doubt. Yeah, well, that's interesting, too, that you did come across it. That's kind of confirming that...
There was some guy that just emailed me from time to time, just sent me the link to that site, you know, and so I find it very interesting.
Huh. Wow. Yes, because I was just also thinking of Jimmy Savile as we were talking, because of course John Lydon is now getting a lot of kudos for having out, you know, spoken
yes,
out.
Yes, because he did. I mean, and the BBC, I mean, obviously the BBC, you know, they were ignorant of that thing going on among some of their celebrity charges, you know, and it does make one wonder to what extent the whole apparatus of the BBC, from the directors on down, were involved in some kind of imitation, which, you know,
yeah,
Savile and creeps like that got to participate in.
Yeah,
but I don't think it didn't just stop with Jimmy Savile. I mean, it was at the BBC, and they've just rolled over it again, haven't they, and just kind of pretended it never happened.
Yeah, they still seem to be complicit in covering it up even now. I mean, there was a recent program that they just brought out, which was essentially discrediting the testimonies of victims of sexual abuse. So, sure.
It involves politicians as well, and presumably involves some very wealthy people, and we're not supposed to know about it, you know. Interesting.
Yeah, well, this is, I mean, it's something I was interested in anyway, as more objectively for years, because I wrote a lot about parapolitical and conspiracies and whatnot. But then recently, I guess, with my brother's death, was really the breakthrough for me of recognizing, you know, how did he end up destroying himself in that way, in that very strange way, which can be glamorized. I mean, thinking of Sid and Nancy, of course.
And that's the problem of that world, is it's, no matter how much you try and make it look realistic, there's always going to be a certain nihilistic glamour and mystique to it. That's always used to really piss me off about the people that I knew who became junkies, was because they acquired this attitude, like, you don't know, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they were desperate. I mean, they were desperately screwed up, unable to function, unable to produce their art, and yet they still, you know, they acquired this attitude that was so annoying, because what they needed was, they needed fucking help, and they weren't going to get it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was interesting, and that's just something that you can never get around through making a movie about it, or through the arts, whether it's Trainspotting or whether Sid and Nancy or whatever. It's all going to come over as some kind of cool thing, you know. So it's very hard to deal with, you know. In the same way, I think they do it with Speed now. I think somehow they manage through, like, Breaking Bad and Winter's Bone, you know, mm-hmm. to kind of make the been ultra-glamorous, which is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it just has to do with anything being dramatized. If you dramatize something, there's an attendant glamour to it, no matter how.
I think there is that, yeah. And there's also the... I mean, what I saw with my brother, and one of the things that I'm trying to correct, in a sense, is that his own testimony was a cover, was a concealment of the wounds and the, you know, the psychological trauma that actually drove him to heroin addiction. And I don't think that gets looked at. Like the idea, I think there's this idea that junkies are making a choice. And that even if it's self-destructive,
no, I know what you mean, though, but
it's not really a choice, is it? It's a result of, you know, very deep wounds that are unconscious, and then there's this unconscious drive to self-destruction, and heroin is a way to numb the pain, essentially. And so there's really nothing glamorous about that. But if you take it out of its context, you have this kind of nihilistic my way thing, like Sid.
Yeah, and then I mean, Sid Vicious is a person who was totally screwed up in his childhood. Didn't have a chance, you know,
yeah.
as far as I could see. So yeah, I mean, I think in some cases, I don't know if it's the same in every case, because I've seen people who were like, who came from very wealthy and privileged backgrounds, you know, who had it all, who also became junkies.
Well, that's again, my brother.
What their childhood
that was
like.
My brother, though. I mean, we,
I guess that's
we,
right,
we had it all.
Poor, yeah.
We had it all from a, on a surface level.
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But not, I mean, obviously.
That's funny. I find it so, because for me, the idea of rich people is people who talk in a posh voice, and they don't say town, they say pain. I'm going to Cain today. You know, so it's even hard for me. Somehow your family get a pass because you're from the north. And it's hard for me to remember. I just forget, you know, the problems of wealth and child abuse and stupidity are everywhere, you know.
Yeah, well, I think they're particularly prevalent in a weird way, or in a specific way, in the aristocracy or the upper classes. I mean, our family was weird in more ways than one, though, because we were socialists. So we're,
yeah, that's what's so interesting about the book as well, is it's like, yeah, yeah, it's northern foods and all, yeah.
Well, that was unexpected. I mean, I got these notes about your stuff. Turned out to about my thing, but yeah, it's all interconnected.
Yes, I'm sorry. I guess that after Sebastian died, I suppose that they didn't really feel the momentum to go forward and make a film out of the book. But it's just, if anybody hasn't read the book, I'm sure that many people listening to this haven't read the book. Sebastian's book is really good and really entertaining and worth reading.
Well, that puts me in a weird position because I don't like his book. And because I was there, and I know the people in it, so I mean, obviously my mother is a main character in the book, and to me it's all a kind of distortion of what happened.
Yes.
And in a way that is kind of opportunistic. I felt like my brother glamorized his own pain and his own wounds and turned it into something entertaining for the masses, because he wanted to entertain, and he wanted to be loved, which I can understand. As a failed writer, I've never managed to turn my story into entertainment, and
but you're quite right, because it's a very entertaining book, and if you were his brother and went through that life, it wouldn't be an entertaining subject, you know, and so that was the choice he made, was to make it this very readable,
mm-hmm.
kind of light. I mean, and not just the sort of the childhood, but then the sort of the whole the Jimmy Boyle stuff, and
right.
and then going to the Philippines and being crucified, and his relationship with his drug dealer, where I thought that dramatic reverse that he did when he's gone back to London and he's trying to be a painter, but he's doing more and more drugs, and his dealer is becoming a painter. His dealer is having shows in town, you know, And their positions are reversed. By the end of the thing, Sebastian's just reduced to kind of impotence, and this and the guy who was selling him the coke is now kind of an up-and-coming young art, young London artist.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, he compared it to that movie, The Servant, the Joseph Rosen movie.
Yes. So it's complicated. It's and there are scenes in the thing that I think would make a very good film. But I see. But I hear what you're saying. Obviously, it's completely different if you were there.
Yeah, and then the other thing is a more general way, which is more also where we have stuff to talk about in terms of your experience too. I hope is how much I think my brother covered up and concealed about the world he was in, because. He was hanging out with Jimmy Boyle for years. I mean, they were lovers, and the more I've looked into Jimmy Boyle, I mean, this guy, and I knew him, of course, this is not a pleasant character, and I don't think he was that different after he got out either. But certainly before he was in prison, he was hanging out with the Krays. He was under protection of the Krays when he was in London, and we now know the Krays were linked to Jimmy Savile, to Jersey Island, you know, Haute de Garenne, to these networks of child torture and snuff and the most horrific crimes, really, the deepest level of corruption. That was the world that Jimmy Boyle was moving in, and my brother was so fascinated by that. Like, he wrote letters to the Cray twins, he wrote to Moira Hindley, as did my grandfather. My grandfather was also fascinated by this world, and for years I thought that it was just because they were liberals. Well, my brother was never a liberal, so I didn't have illusions about that. But my grandfather seemed to be a liberal reformer, and I just thought his interest was humanitarian. But, you know...
Like Lord Longford.
Yes, like Lord Longford. Yeah. But one has to question what Lord Longford's motivations were also at this point. I mean, I think Jimmy Savile really has pulled the wool off the eyes of many people, because you see that people who are presenting a public image of social concern and charity work and all the rest of it are using it as a cover for their own devious activities, which is part of a very profitable industry of crime, basically a crime industry, which includes entertainment and politicians and all the rest of it. And it seems like that was the world that my brother was in, and his fascination for all kinds of sexual experimentation. Where did that lead? Like, what did he leave out of the book? Because he wouldn't have been able to write about it without risking reprisals.
Well, that was the amazing thing, was that Jimmy Boyle didn't seem to be offended. I mean, maybe he was offended, but he didn't seem to have taken any kind of retaliatory action to being outed in the book, which was pretty interesting, I thought, because I haven't seen him in years, but I know David Heyman, obviously, because he played McLaren.
Right, right.
And he also played Jimmy Boyle in the TV movie, that very good film.
Yes, The Sense of Freedom. And you wanted Heyman for Walker as well, is that right?
Yeah, I wanted to originally have Heyman play Walker, but they wouldn't go for a non-American. And Ed Harris was just perfect. I mean, couldn't have done better than Ed anyway. But I also was thinking, what an irony if we'd made the Sebastian film to have Heyman come back as well.
Right.
Of course.
Right.
But I know what you're saying, because the thing is, if we were talking about Mexico or Guatemala, and we were talking about a kind of a criminal conspiracy involving gangsters and pedophiles, politicians, popular entertainers, sure. Mm-hmm. Nobody would doubt it. Mm-hmm. But transfer that same notion to England or to the United States, it couldn't be.
Right.
That's just crazy talk.
Yeah.
And yet, I mean... But I mean, just the way you describe it, you only have to transfer that to a country where we think things are more chaotic, and it seems perfectly believable. And of course, every country is totally chaotic.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very interesting, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the evidence is all there, and it's...
But it's to be put together, as you say, it has to be put together in a larger sense so that it becomes clear, because otherwise it's all just fragmentary evidence that doesn't get drawn together, even... as far as the way you've drawn it on your website.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I try not to jump to conclusions either, because I mean, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm not trying to actually map it out in such a way I can say this is what's going on. But it's just, if you put enough of the pieces together, you could see that they are interconnected. It's just, it's a question of how big the picture is something I don't know, and what are the different levels of awareness, and who knows. So
do you read Lobster?
I do read it, and I mean, I've read it, and I've actually contacted Stephen Dorrell about talking on this podcast, and I sent him my material to see what you know, somebody who'd done a lot of the really sort of, you know, detailed research into MI5 and all the rest of it, to see what he would make of my own family history as I see it in the context of all of this. And so I'm, yes, is the short answer.
So that's, well, the thing is, they, Ramsey and Darrell split a lot of 20 years ago, I think, that Lobster split in two. And Darrell had something that was called the original Darrell Lobster for a while, but I don't think it endured. But there's still Lobster, which was a print, a Power Politics magazine in print, and is now online.
Yeah.
I think it's lobster-magazine.co.uk or something like that. But anyway, but Ramsey, who was Darrell's partner, is still doing it, and some of his correspondents touch on bits of this stuff. So it might be an interesting resource. You know, there might be more little pieces of it, but it does need, it's hard to put it together, and then hard to find a publisher or a forum in which to address it. You know, I mean. And you are, as you're right, you're right not to go, not to step beyond what you know, and not to theorize in ways that then, you know, aren't substantiated. So.
Yeah, I think it's too, and there's, I mean, there's so much crap out there. That's one of the things I was wanting to talk to you about as well. It's like, because I know that you've gone out publicly talking about 9/11. And JFK, of course, you wrote the book for Feral House, so JFK is kind of safe territory nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's necessarily, I don't think one needs to be worried about being called a conspiracy theorist. I know it's like a kind of an insult for the media,
yeah,
you know, they say, oh, he's a conspiracy theorist and he wears a tinfoil hat, you know. But a conspiracy, if one would look in the dictionary, perish the thought, we would ever look at what a word means.
Yeah.
A conspiracy is an agreement by two or more people to commit a crime. So the official version of 9/11, which is that this mad mullah in a cave on a dialysis machine sent his Saudi surrogates to the US to do these terrible things, that is a conspiracy theory.
Sure, yeah.
Because it's a conspiracy. It's an agreement by two or more people to commit a crime. And so we can be conspiracy theorists and not worry about it.
Except that Cameron just passed a law against it, I think.
Oh, it's against the law. That's right. But, you know, Thatcher tried to make the use of the word Sandinista a crime. Thatcher literally had proposed that nobody be allowed to say or write the word Sandinista because they were a terrorist group.
Wow.
And that was the reason that the Clash, who weren't particularly engaged with the Nicaraguan thing, that was the reason that the Clash called their album Sandinista, was a defiance of that Thatcherian overreach. And so in the same way, Cameron may think that he can outlaw conspiracy theories, but we'll see about that.
So that Clash, that's another overlap, because you worked a lot with Joe Strummer, of course, and the Clash went to the Gateway. They hung out at the Gateway for a while, you know, the rehabilitation centre that Sebastian and Jimmy Ball had in Edinburgh.
Ah, no, I know they had that, but I only knew Strummer after the Clash were over, sadly. You know, I mean, I'd seen the Clash a couple of times play, but I only met him after that. After the demise of the band.
Right. Yeah, it seems like a small world sometimes.
Isn't it funny? It is pretty interesting, actually, the sort of the smallness of this, especially.
Yeah.
And it was interesting talking to Sebastian about Leiden as well, because my experience of meeting Leiden, both times that I met him, he was like really nice.
Uh-huh.
Really sharp and really sharp and intelligent, but really, you know, like a nice, well-intentioned guy, you know.
So. Right, but and was that after Sid and Nancy or during? Because he didn't like...
Before and after. Once before, and he was kind enough to invite Drew Schofield, the actor who played him, to come over to New York and hang out with him and sort of see what his what he was like, you know. But John said... that he thought it was a mistake to try and recreate the Sex Pistols.
Mm-hmm.
He said that if he was directing it, he would make it like a band like the Sex Pistols, but an imaginary one. So he said that Drew should be leader of the band, but he should be a Scouser. He should stay in Liverpool accent, you know. I think in retrospect, that's probably right.
Mm.
Rather than try and do a recreation where then people get judged on how good of an imitation of Sid Vicious does Gary Oldman do? Very good, you know. How good is Drew's imitation of Johnny Rotten? Well, it's not bad, you know. I mean, instead of those being, you know, how like Nancy is Chloe, instead of questions like that, you know, if it was kind of quasi-fictionalized, then it would might have been better.
Mm. Yeah, I think there is.
That was Leiden. That was what Leiden thought, anyway. And maybe he was right.
Mm-hmm. So I got to take this opportunity to ask you about Chloe. I've forgotten the name now. The actress, Courtney Love.
Chloe Webb, who played Nancy.
Courtney Love.
Oh, the other C.
Yeah.
Courtney Love.
Yeah.
Haven't seen her in a long time either. I think I had a dream about her the other night. I think I dreamt I met her again. But I haven't seen her in years.
Did you see the documentary about Courtney Love and Kurt Cobain and the private detective who believes that Courtney was involved in Cobain's murder?
No, I didn't, but I love the idea of it.
Yeah.
I think it sounds great, you know. Is it Michael Winterbottom documentary?
No, because he's pretty prestigious, Winterbottom, isn't he?
No, not Michael Winterbottom. There's another director. Nick Broomfield.
That was the one a long time back. He did that for the BBC, and then there's been a more recent one, which goes more deeply
one.
Into it.
And the more recent one is the one that's got the theory that Courtney...
Well,
Courtney had Kurt done
away absolutely,
with.
But I think Broomfield did... He got pretty close to that if he didn't come out and actually say it. It's certainly been around for quite a long time anyway, this conspiracy theory.
It's another situation in which when I knew the person, they were relatively, or they seemed to me relatively normal, you know. I mean, Courtney obviously was very larger than life and very determined character, you know, and a little bit crazy, but holding it all together, you know, and destined for some kind of stardom, you know. And then she gets together with that guy, and they become junkies, you know. And I'm sure Kurt Cobain had a very difficult childhood, and Courtney had a very difficult childhood. But at some point, we can't just say everybody that became a junkie had a difficult childhood. I mean, some people just do it because they're fucking flakes, you know, and they just do it because they fall into it because their friends are doing it. They think it's clever. They think they won't become addicted.
Well, maybe, but they could say that everyone had a difficult childhood, but then, of course, that makes it all a bit blurry, but I mean...
Oh, no, but I don't think we should say that, because I had a pretty nice childhood. I mean, my childhood wasn't a difficult one, like a lot of people had to suffer through, you know. I'm not complaining at all.
Yeah, well, I'm not complaining.
And that's why I'm confident. That's one of the reasons I've been able to achieve what little I've achieved, is because I wasn't screwed up in my childhood,
uh-huh.
You know, and it's really... And I'm very grateful to I picked my parents well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I thought my childhood was fine until I turned 40 or so, and then I started questioning it. But then I didn't actually remember most of my childhood, so that in itself was an indication of something.
See, my mother is something of a mystic. I mean, they're very different. I mean, also kind of socialists. Kind of lower middle class, kind of well intentioned, maybe my father's a little bit more of a conservative, my mother more of a labor. But she's really a kind of a mystic. You know, she talks to God, which I am not.
Yeah, okay.
And so, and one thing I did get out of her, even though she wouldn't really confess overtly, I did get from her the idea that money is really evil.
Mm-hmm.
So I've never been able to acquire much money. And I never have enough money to make the films I want to make. But because I've just got this idea that money is, like, really evil.
Hmm.
And that to focus on money is really, really evil.
Right.
You know? So that's what I got from my childhood.
Yeah. Well, there seems to be some merit in that view. I kind of got that view in a real skewed way by being given loads of money and realizing how much it screwed me up and how much it wasn't a substitute for my father's love, right? I mean, money was no substitute.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? And that's love is more... And that's the other thing, because I think love is the most important thing of all. I mean, the Christian stuff about faith, love, and charity, you know, I mean, I'm sorry, faith, hope, and charity. Faith and hope are the same thing anyway, and who cares about either of them? You can't influence the future.
Mm.
But love is something you can actually practice on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think charity, I think that the charity is translated as love.
Charity,
yeah,
the same thing. I mean, it's like,
it was agape, like higher love or something, I think was the original meaning.
Love is all you need, man. I mean, if we all just love each other, then everything's going to be okay.
So I was listening to you yesterday, you were talking about Walker, and something I hadn't heard about was, I found interesting in this larger political context, that that Universal pulled a fast one on Castro in order to prevent him giving...
In order to keep the film out of the competition.
Yeah.
That was very sophisticated.
Yeah.
Because we were in, because they were trying to suppress the distribution of the film internationally, and we had put the film in competition in Havana, which as an American film we weren't supposed to do, because American film violated the embargo. American films weren't supposed to be playing in the Havana Film Festival at all.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd violated the embargo by doing that. And what Universal said to the, I don't think they said it directly to Fidel, you know, I don't think he actually involved himself in the film festival to that extent, but what they said to the organizers of the film festival was, take Walker out of competition and we will give you an official American entry for the festival.
Mm-hmm.
Which was Cheech Marin's Born in East LA.
Mm-hmm.
And the organizers thought, this is it, the end of the embargo. sure, we'll throw Cox's film to the wolves because this is the end of the embargo. They honestly believed, so naive were they honestly believed that the embargo was going to end, that there was going to be a flood of American studio films coming into Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
And of course it didn't happen.
Right.
So it's interesting, isn't it, how naive the most principled and idealistic of perhaps the most principled and most idealistic are inevitably the most naive.
Well, but Castro is really savvy as well. I mean, in terms of that, in terms of resisting American influences, that was one of the things that he really excelled at, right? So it is remarkable that they managed to get one by him there. But I think even
I'm sure he personally wasn't.
No, I know, but still, his.
It's like, you know, it's like us imagining that Putin knows our names, you know. I mean, but you know, but I certainly think the people in the apparat who were equally ideological and equally keen on supporting the revolution, but they just thought, you know, hey, we're going to get American movies at last.
Right. But what's also interesting, maybe even more interesting, is that Universal, I mean, Walker was their film too, right? So they went to great effort to reduce the exposure of one of their own films, including tricking, you know.
Well, traditionally Universal have been pretty naughty about making films and then not releasing them. I mean, even as far as the studio is concerned, I mean, they have probably got the worst track record in terms of all the films you think of that they made, like Repo Man, Walker, Rumblefish, Tulane Blacktop, Dennis Hopper's The Last Movie,
mm-hmm.
all of these very interesting films that Universal commissioned in an attempt to appear hip, in an attempt to kind of, you know, these gray bureaucrats, you know, trying to kind of figure out what the young people like, you know. And so the Universal kind of has a history for doing that.
For not supporting films that they make, but isn't this more a case of them actually suppressing their own film?
Well, I think they did their best to sabotage The Last Movie.
Yeah.
They hated Rumblefish for some reason. I can't figure out why that was. Oh, I think I know, actually. It was a regime change because Rumblefish, Francis Coppola's film Rumblefish and Repo Man were made under the regime of a guy at Universal. I've forgotten his name now. Anyway, he was fired and a new studio head came in called Frank Price. And so Frank Price naturally had to justify the faith of the of Wasserman and the guys who ran the studio who'd given him the job by making previous incumbents' films fail.
Right.
And so that affected both Repo Man and Rumblefish. And I think that's fairly normal at the studio, that a new broom comes in and all the old movies that were done by the previous regime are going to be sabotaged.
Right. So do you think that was the case with Walker, or was it also the political content of Walker?
In the case of Walker, it was the political content, because the regime didn't change. The regime was consistent throughout Walker. It was one guy called Pollock, but I remember at one point I was in Pollock's office. He was nominally the studio head, and so he was supposed to be the top guy in the whole apparat, right? And so I and Lorenzo O'Brien, the producer, were in his office talking about, I think we wanted more money for the poster or something like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the middle of the meeting that we've got with this guy, his door just opens and a hand comes in and a finger beckons to him. And this guy Pollock just jumps up and runs out of his office, you know, and shuts the door behind him. And there's another minor executive in there. And so I say in a loud voice, oh, was that Lou Wasserman?
Mm-hmm.
And the executive puts his fingers to his lips, like, you know. And then Pollock comes back in again, and it shamefacedly goes, oh, well, that was Lou, you know. And I'm thinking, you pathetic bastard, you know. I mean, this guy has got so little respect for you that he just opens the door of your office while you're in a meeting, sticks his finger in and beckons you out, and you go running.
Right.
You know, and if that's the kind of life that you want to lead, then go work for the studio.
So did you, I mean, did it occur to you at the time of Walker, like, that there might be some sort of political control of the studios? Was that something that you were already aware of, or was that your first hint of that, or?
I had actually, a few years previously, I had read a script for Dennis Hopper, which was called Easy Rider 2, and they were trying to do a re some guys were trying to do a remake of Easy Rider 2. One of the authors was a guy called Nelson Lyon, who was some way tied up with John Belushi and that crowd. Maybe he was a Saturday Night Live writer, and he had written, co-written the script. So Dennis had got me to read the script and make notes, and then I had to go and talk to this guy Nelson Lyon about it and try and walk him through, basically try and walk him through the motorcycle part of it, because they obviously weren't really motorcycle guys. So I went and had this meeting with this guy on behalf of Dennis, just to talk about the script and improving it. And I'm sitting, it's like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'm sitting with this guy, and he's still in his bathrobe. In his house in Beverly Hills, is in his bathrobe, 2 in the afternoon, sitting under a French movie poster, like Au revoir les enfants, or whatever. And I said something about how I thought, personally, I found something in the script, like really right wing or really racist, or, you know, maybe that wasn't intentional, maybe they could tweak it a bit, you know. And this guy went off, and he said, "You don't realize. You don't realize everything's changed. All that liberal bullshit is over. You know, these are the kick-ass times are coming back. These are going to be the kick-ass times." And this was like the early 80s.
Right.
And this guy, this bald guy, sitting in his bathrobe in Beverly Hills, 2 o'clock in the afternoon under a French movie poster, telling me, "The kick-ass times are coming back," you know. But he was right. So clearly in the studios, you know, and in the Hollywood weirdo world, they all knew that this imperial wave was going to come rolling through again, and we were going to be involved in more wars. Movies were going to just turn into pure propaganda exercises for the state. He saw that coming.
Right.
Wasn't that, I thought that was interesting.
So that, in retrospect, that was a bit of a tip-off, something that you've discovered more, that you
Yeah,
confirmed
I mean,
through.
it's funny that they say the studios are a sort of liberal conspiracy, because I don't really think in. But I think in America they have this notion about liberals and conservatives and stuff, and they think that they're different.
Yeah.
But it's really like choosing between Tony Blair and David Cameron. I think you kind of get the same whichever, or Hillary Clinton and you know, Jeb Bush. You're going to get whichever one you pick. You're going to get the same.
Right. Sure. I mean, I think it's becoming, it's hard to say whether something's becoming more publicly known or whether it's actually just becoming more true, but the CIA's involvement in film production is certainly becoming more known, and it also seems to be becoming more overt in terms of them actually shaping projects now rather than simply.
It's very overt now. I mean, you just have to go online and do a search for Pentagon or CIA involvement in the movies. There's a guy at the University of Bristol who's doing some research and has done freedom of information into the different people who go to ask the studios for money, and they're inefficient about. I mean, they go to ask the Pentagon for support, you know, in lieu of money, and the redactions are very inconsistent, so you can normally get a glimpse. It's obvious it's Steven Spielberg. It's obvious it's Dick Fincher looking for money or looking for support from the Pentagon or looking for CIA handout or something, you know. And so it's interesting. And when you think that in the, for a brief time, like in the 60s and the 70s, one thought that the movies might actually be an art form opposition
Yeah.
to the imperial project, you know, it is a little disappointing how things have turned out.
Yeah. Well, you know about Operation Mockingbird, I guess.
Yes.
So, I mean, that was That's very widely known now, the CIA's involvement in mainstream media and in shaping the public perception of
things. It's widely known, but it's interesting that the person who made it widely known, Carl Bernstein, never got to work again, never wrote an article after
right.
that. Whereas Carl Woodward, his partner in the Watergate business, has gone from strength to strength. Sort of the core
I didn't know that. I mean, I knew Carl Bernstein was, because I just read something by Carl Bernstein about this. About
he
Mockingbird.
Wrote the pivotal piece about Mockingbird. He wrote the piece that exposed Mockingbird.
Okay.
And never got like a gig again.
Really?
You know, I don't know what he's been doing. I think he's been teaching.
Huh. No, I didn't realize that, because, yeah, Bob.
But his journalistic career was over after he exposed Mockingbird.
Wow. And as you say, Bob Woodward, he wrote a rather fluffy CIA thing, didn't he?
Onward and upward, but he's ex-naval intelligence.
Right.
So, and I suspect that if you've worked in the...
There are no exes,
you know, just
yeah.
like John le Carré, never really leave it, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the impression you get.
So, yeah, well, I was just thinking in terms of Mockingbird as a sort of template, like what became clear there wasn't just that the CIA infiltrated major media, but that they basically ran the major media. So it's possible to look at, I mean, like Time Life, for example, it's possible to look at Hollywood through that lens, again, somewhat theoretical, but just to see if the facts fit, that studios may actually be run by intelligence operatives. Major directors we think of, they're not just getting the permission of or the support of, they may even themselves be working for intelligence, feeling very important and justified.
Well, and quite often actively so, because you get Hollywood film directors and screenwriters asked to war game and strategize, you know, potential, you know, war scenarios or terrorist scenarios. I mean, this has been going on for a long time, but especially since 9/11, 2001. It's interesting because some people in what is sometimes called the community actually are against it. I mean, you do occasionally read lists of names of actors and movie people who speak out against it and decry the influence of the CIA and the military in Hollywood. But
I haven't heard that. Is there anyone that I would know?
I can't remember anymore because I forget everybody's name. I think Jake Gyllenhaal is on the side of the Angels and a number of other people, but I've forgotten all their names. I've blogged about it somewhere. If you kind of scroll back through the Alex Cox Films thing, there's a piece I gleaned all this stuff off from the internet and wrote a piece about CIA influence.
Okay, well, that's certainly the... I mean, if it's the same piece, that was the piece that really drew my attention to you more recently, as you know, because I was writing about The Counselor, which I found a very interesting movie, and that was made, while that was being made, Tony Scott died, whether he suicided or was suicided or whatever the true story is around that. Who knows?
I want to read his suicide note where he regrets all the bad films he made. And he regrets what a horrible, horrible part he played at turning the industry into this propaganda enterprise. You know?
Yeah, well, he would be an interesting case study in this regard, wouldn't he? Because he made some good films, and even some of the bad propaganda films he made were good in quotes, in the sense that they were very well done and they were very compelling.
Leeds boys, aren't they? The Scott brothers are both Leeds boys. They like come from up north, you know. Made their money in commercials, you know.
Advertising trends.
You know, just after war, this truck coming uphill, you know, and then they go to Hollywood and they're like the fucking bee's knees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But money can't buy you happiness.
Isn't it a very blurry line? I mean, you're talking about Gyllenhaal being on the side of the Angels, and this is one of the things that I wrestle with, and one of the things I'm always curious when I'm speaking to, I would say, someone like yourself, because I don't generally get a chance to speak to anyone who, like yourself, who's kind of been an insider for a while. I mean, you definitely are a known director, so you really were briefly like an established, I won't say Hollywood, but going Hollywood, and so you've glimpsed the you know, the inner chambers, so to speak, of the structures of power. I mean, is it possible to, like, how possible is it to be in that world of power and actually be genuinely trying to do something from the heart and from the soul that is by its very nature subversive, that isn't going to be able to be used as propaganda one way or another without being compromised at some point? I mean, I'm not making this a very clear question, but my question relates to, like, how much is success within the industry, whether it's the BBC or whether it's Hollywood or whether it's whatever, dependent on being compromised, on actually being complicit with the crimes that actually maintain those power structures, if you see what I mean. Like, when you join the mafia, you have to kill someone, right? Otherwise, you're not trustworthy.
I mean, the answer to the question is, you know, it's not possible to remain aloof from bad things, you know, if you're going to be engaged in the world in any way. I mean, whatever struggle you're engaged with, even if it's like the most noble struggle of all, suppose you're like, you know, the sea shepherd guy is trying to prevent the extermination of the whales, you know, an entirely noble and worthwhile enterprise. And yet, then you get caught up in the global propaganda battle between the United States and Russia, and so all of a sudden you're a ping pong ball, you know, and the Russians don't like you, so that makes you a tool of the Americans, but all you care about is the whales,
right?
You know, and how you, nobody gets out alive, you know, how you can't, you're going to be, something is going to compromise you somewhere along the line. To get caught, trapped, your own hubris or your own poor judgment will lead you into situations where you compromise yourself and are a fuck up. And then, you know, but you just got to carry on. You just got to get over that and learn from your experiences and try not to screw up in the same way again.
Mm-hmm.
Find other ways of screwing up henceforth.
Well, do you think that, because one of my views is essentially is that failure in the most superficial sense is often a sign of integrity. So.
Oh, but we mustn't believe that either, because then that's a sort of a way of reassuring ourselves that everything's okay.
Well, of course, I'm aware of that danger, but I mean, and I try not to apply it to myself because of that, but. In your case, let's say, do you feel that your unwillingness or inability to compromise in ways that really would compromise your sense of what's right have prevented you from having more financial material success within the film industry, let's say? I mean, are you aware of that, that there are certain lines that you're not willing to cross, and because of that, you've been blocked from advancing?
No, it was a done deal with Walker. I mean, there was, for me, it was very, there was that, that was the moment at which I had transgressed and wasn't going to access large sums of oligarchical money anymore.
Right.
And so there wasn't the process thereafter where I was kind of invited back in and given another opportunity to redeem myself or anything like that. I mean, those doors were all closed
at that point
back in 1987. So, but being as I was still alive,
yeah,
and had to do something, I just carried on, you know. And it's interesting that I'm kind of, as I get near the end, I'm kind of like wrapping it all up. I'm making in a low budget way the projects that I really, really wanted to make years ago, you know. And so even though I made like Build a Galactic Hero for like 100,000 students in Colorado, I still think it's a better film than Starship Troopers.
Mm-hmm.
I think the book is a better book than Starship Troopers, and I think that ultimately that Bill is a clearer and more successful film than Starship Troopers, even if it didn't cost $100 million.
Right.
But that's just my opinion. But I mean, my opinion is the only one that matters, because it's my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And no disrespect to John Davison, who produced Starship Troopers and did a magnificent job of production on the film, but I still think Bill is better.
So just going back quickly to the walk at this turning point where you said the doors were slammed, was it what was your transgression? I mean, was it many, multiple, or was the one specific thing?
I made a film in Nicaragua with American money at the time the United States was at war with Nicaragua. And when the studio and the Bond Company attempted to shut the production down, I thwarted them. They were unable to shut it down.
How did you do that?
Ironically, if Walker had been a fiasco, if Walker had fallen apart, if we hadn't finished it, then that would have served the Americans well, because it would have demonstrated that Nicaragua is a chaotic and dangerous place. I would have been forgiven, but my crime was to finish it.
Right, and so were you given an option at a certain point where you told if you do what we say, then you can go on to better things? Or, I mean, was there ever any point where you actually?
Well, at a certain point in your career, you get offered, if in that kind of, I don't know how it works nowadays, but certainly there was a time when if you were an up-and-coming director, studios or financiers would offer you like pre-existing projects. And so I have to sit in Nancy,
Oops.
direct the Three Amigos.
Yeah, you cut out there, but I just you were off for Three Amigos after Sid and Nancy.
I was asked to direct the Three Amigos.
That's crazy.
But it wasn't really a film that they related to, and also, weirdly enough, I was involved in this Straight to Hell endeavor with all of those guys, and so doing a kind of mariachi themed western of my own. So I turned down the Three Amigos. I turned down the opportunity to direct the sequel to RoboCop, and I was offered the chance to direct a film called The Running Man, which actually is quite a good film. I thought I quite enjoyed that, and I read the script and I thought it was pretty interesting. But I said, I'm making this movie Walker. Oh, well, you see, you won't be able to make Walker because we're going into production on The Running Man, very soon. So if you want to direct The Running Man, $20 million, $30 million film, come on over, But I would have had to give up the project I was in development on.
Right.
And obviously being more ideological and having the thing kind of, within the possibility of making it, that was the priority.
So, but while you were actually working on Walker, was there any point where you were felt that you were being pressured to abandon it?
Oh yeah. Throughout. But I won't bore you with the story, because in fact, if anyone's listening and wants to actually cares about this arcane stuff, I wrote a book about it. And if you go online or go to the bookstore, there's a book, I should say, called X Films or 10 Films. And it's about 10 films that I made, but the main piece is all about Walker and what went on during the shooting of Walker. So if anyone is interested in that, they can probably get that book for like 50 cents off the internet.
Right. Yeah, I didn't know about that.
Yeah, it's sitting out there waiting for your doors.
Nowhere to run.
So I know we both have a maybe an abiding, maybe lifelong, definitely abiding interest in Sam Peckinpah, and he was also blacklisted.
Not really, no.
Well,
I mean, he was for a little while after Major Dundee.
Well, it was, wasn't it? It was after he got fired from Cincinnati Kid, wasn't it?
That's right. He did Major Dundee, and he started Cincinnati Kid, and then they kicked him off that. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, he was back again before too long. I mean, the gap between Major Dundee and the Wild Bunch was only 4 years.
It was only 4 years, but it was his absolute prime, based on the Wild Bunch, you know. I mean, one could also say that he wouldn't have put so much into the Wild Bunch if he didn't feel that it was his last shot. But still, in terms of his alcoholism and all the rest of it, there was that period in the 60s where he really was at his creative peak. And it seems, or would have been, have you ever wondered about that? Like, what happened on Cincinnati Kid and how he managed to get blacklisted over what seems a fairly trivial thing? Because the official story is he was shooting too many nude scenes with Tuesday Weld, and which seems an odd reason for any studio to fire him.
Normally comes down to personalities. I mean, unless they've been just instructed to shut the thing down, which they obviously weren't, because somebody else finished it. It must just have been a personality thing between him and one of the producers.
You think? See, I always imagine some sort of paranoid scenario where there's some hidden hidden motivation there going on, and, you know, the unofficial story is...
Yeah, no, I mean, it's interesting because in a way both Peckinpah and Dennis Hopper were victims of having grown up in the Hollywood world, because they couldn't find a way to make films outside the system. And that's terrible, because both, I think, Dennis... I didn't know Sam Peckinpah, so don't know what his game plan was, if he had one. But I know that Dennis wanted to direct more, but he couldn't find a way outside the studio system. He only knew the studio system. And though the studios let him be an actor, but they wouldn't let him direct again after the last movie.
How well did you know Dennis Hopper?
Pretty well, because I worked for him on a couple of projects, and I wrote a script for him called Backtrack, and I was around when they had done Colors, and Colors was coming out, and there was the controversy about Colors. He was a very nice guy.
Because I know he did that movie Flashback. You remember that, with Kiefer Sutherland? Did you ever see that?
Yeah, that's the one he acts in. Yeah, I didn't really pay much attention to his acting. I think of him as a director.
Well, I was just brought it up because there's certain, I don't know if they're rumours or what they are, but that Dennis Hopper was really quite right-wing, and that his whole liberal thing was just an act, really. Did you ever get...
No, that's the thing about liberal right-wing. It's kind of the same. I mean, if you think about Easy Rider... The aspiration of the characters in Easy Rider, the two heroes, after they've been to Mardi Gras, what are they going to do? They don't know. The only thing they can think of doing is go to New Orleans, is go to Florida and buy property. They're going to be property speculators. Uh-huh. So I think Dennis was always like that. Dennis was always kind of like the Kansas property speculator, who was also an actor and a director. But he was very canny about money. You know, he invested heavily in property. He invested in art, in modern art, and built up a valuable collection. He was very savvy about money. He didn't hate money. But before he died, he had switched from Reagan to Obama. He was an Obama Democrat. Right. You know, so I think it just depended on. What way the wind was blowing at the time, you know. And it also shows how little difference there is between being a Reagan Republican and being a Obama Democrat.
Are you familiar with Dave McGowan's work?
No.
He's written a lot about Laurel Canyon. I would say his best stuff actually is about serial killers programmed to kill, and about how the military trained a lot of these supposedly random serial killers, part of the military.
Oh, I've just been watching Manchurian Candidate, funnily enough. I was watching that.
The original.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the original.
So yeah, he wrote about that and very in-depth stuff. But then he's more famous for this Laurel Canyon stuff, which is kind of speculative, but just amassing a lot of evidence that the Laurel Canyon music movement in the 60s, and it wasn't really a movement, but you know, that nexus of creativity in Laurel Canyon was part of a kind of social engineering thing.
Being done by whom?
Well, he doesn't really name names. He just links all of these different countercultural figures to their military families and the way they were mysteriously given contracts with nothing, you know, to show, and just how they were backed and supported. And so he's.
Well, I guess, I mean, certainly the acid thing, I mean, there was this hope that the, I mean, acid, when acid was being used by the CIA and by the military as a sort of a potential tool. I mean, I guess at the beginning of the 60s, there was a fair bit of that. You know, we'll put acid in the drink and see what happens, you know, and let's
Yeah,
try
well,
it
in
out
the
if it
50s with
works,
MK
you know.
Ultra, even was the initial use of it, I think, was
As far as you can tell, it became it was never reliable. Speed and cocaine are reliable drugs for the empire, and the opiates are a kind of backup. But the hallucinogens are always a bit dodgy. Never know what people are going to do. They might throw down their guns.
So, speaking of hallucinogens, what was your experience like with Fear and Loathing? Was that a very unpleasant experience, all told?
Oh, no, writing the script was great. I mean, I wrote the script with Todd Davies and my wife, and we had a great time writing it. And she had taught it at UCLA. When she was teaching at UCLA, she was doing this kind of remedial thing for undergraduates who were in danger of falling out. And so she would use Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas as like a book to get their attention because it had all these drugs. And but it's a great book. And so she would use that to kind of draw them back into the idea that reading books wasn't boring. And so she'd really thought about the book a lot and come up with a kind of a structure for it. And my involvement in it was limited to casting and to writing the screenplay. Because they took it to Universal, and Universal wasn't an acceptable director.
I thought so. You never got past the screenplay stage then.
No, I was casting too. I cast the film as well.
You cast it as it turned out, that you
Yes.
cast Johnny Depp. Oh, well, that was a great bit of casting.
Maybe. I
And that
thought he was a
was.
bit underpowered, actually. I was a bit disappointed, I think, because the other guy, the guys who had the thing, who had the rights, the producers weren't very experienced, and they'd gone out and offered the part of Hunter Thompson to two actors, to Johnny Depp and to John Cusack, which obviously was a huge embarrassment and a mistake, because you must never, you know, must never do that, you know. So one of the reasons they hired me was to sort that out. I'm not sure. I think maybe John Cusack would have done a better job,
Really?
but it's unknown. But I was the one that brought Benicio del Toro into the frame.
Yeah. Did you meet Hunter S. Thompson?
Yes. He had a video crew with him the whole time. And if you go online, somewhere on the internet, there's a video of me and Todd sitting with Hunter S. Thompson, trying to get him to concentrate on the screenplay, and trying to remind him about Ralph Steadman and what Steadman's cartoons were like.
Did you have any thoughts about his death? Like, again, conspiracy theories around that?
I thought it was inevitable because he was like really messed up. He was very, very seriously addicted to drugs, to alcohol, and to television. And he was surrounded by enablers like Johnny Depp, you know, and so it was only a matter of time before he was going to take his own life.
Johnny Depp was Hunter's enabler.
Yes. Johnny Depp and all of those Hollywood types, they were all encouraging him. You know, oh, go do something crazy, you know, take some acid, go shoot a can of propane, you know. I mean, they were like really, they were quite devilish, encouraging him to not look for help.
Did you hear that he was working on something about 9/11? when he died?
No, he did a, he wrote a very good piece. He wrote a good article, and they interviewed him on the telephone for one of the versions of Loose Change.
Oh.
And they used the telephone interview with as a little introduction to, I think, the second or the third iteration, four or five different versions of it, and it was one of the, it was the second or the third one, they had a little introduction, but it was just Hunter Thompson down the telephone line. I'm sorry to say, I don't think he was capable of any kind of constructive activity by the time we met him. He was pretty far gone.
Oh, really? He was still writing, wasn't he?
No. Well. Oh, yeah, he wrote an angry, yeah, I mean, occasionally, because, you know how it is, you know, they read the New York Times, they get mad, they write something. And he did write a very good piece right after 9/11. He wrote a good and coherent piece. But it was only a short piece.
Mm-hmm. Do you know that David Lynch spoke out briefly about 9/11?
A number of people did, I think. I mean, a number of people sort of thought it was bogus, you know. But you know.
Well, so I don't think it helped Lynch's career.
I think the thing is, it's that the there is a, and a, well, I think Lynch has hurt his own career primarily by going around high schools trying to sell transcendental meditation. You know, I think he's revealed himself to be a complete fool. And
oh, you think he's been suckered about that?
I think he's a complete fool. I mean, I think he's just a total fucking fool who's squandered the opportunity to be an interesting independent film director. Trying to sell snake oil to high school kids.
Uh-huh.
I talked to some kids who'd been at a high school that he went to, and he apparently has a very squeaky voice, and he goes up on stage and he says, "I used to beat my wife every day. TM, it works." And these kids were just hysterical. After I was at their parents' house when they came home from the David Lynch Transcendental Meditation lecture, and they were doing this kind of squeaky Mickey Mouse voice all afternoon and mocking Lynch. I'm just, what have you done? You know, to be an independent filmmaker is so important. You know, if you really think something serious about 9/11, say something serious, make a film about it.
Mm-hmm.
But to devote your time to, like, well, anyway. Everybody makes money. Everybody wants to make money, right? You know.
Oh, you think it's? Oh, I think he generally seems to believe in TM, but I would agree that he seems to have been fooled in some way, because I think he already had access to his own unconscious and had a natural ability to tune into whatever we want to call that dimension, which showed in his work. And yeah, Blue Velvet certainly sorted me out a lot more in certain ways than Transcendental Meditation, I think, would have if I tried it. I can't actually say, because
yeah.
I didn't, right?
Yeah,
but see, I'm very suspicious about these spiritual movements, because I know that, you know, Esalen is connected to the CIA, and you were talking about LSD. I think the intelligence agencies are deeply involved in spiritual movements.
Well,
as
and religion is just another means of control. Religion is a means by which people gain control over
yeah.
other people and maintain control from one generation to another. I'll never forget going into some Church of England one time in England. I was walking in, it was during the sermon, and the priest, what they call the guy, is up there in the pulpit, and he's saying, "Lord, let us always remember to accept the power of those who have been put in authority over us."
Right.
I thought, wait a minute, no, hang on. Nobody has been put in authority over me. I don't accept anybody's authority, you know, unless they earn it, unless they actually can demonstrate to me that they are competent at something. And it's just so interesting, the kind of how religion is really this terrible, terrible means of control and means of the destruction of the planet, you know.
Mm. Well, I think that's... I mean, have you heard the term weaponized meme?
Yeah.
I mean, you could say... Of course, you could say religion's a weaponized meme, but specifically the idea of God, in a sense, is a weaponized meme, because it is a fundamental concept of a higher authority, and that the universe is a hierarchy with
yeah.
this great presiding tyrant at the top of that.
It's mad sky god. Up there in the sky is this rage-filled patriarch. And if you want to believe that, I've got some more crazy ideas. You know, like he has a son, you know, and but no wife, and but this lady gets pregnant via a bird.
And he's all good and all loving, but he'll send you to hell.
Yeah, you're gonna burn in hell forever. Yeah, no, it's interesting. It is interesting. But it's all means of controlling people and maintaining the oligarchy of power. Whichever oligarchy it is, you know, the church is always a very valuable asset.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we've been babbling for an hour and a half, and I actually have to go and get snow tires put on my truck.
Is your fire still burning?
The fire's still burning, dog's still here, everything's okay.
Okay, well, I do want to ask you one quick question.
Yeah.
It might seem frivolous, but I know you're into Kubrick. I'm not really, but I'm interested by how people are so fascinated by him. Did you watch Room 237, and what do you think about Kubrick faking the moon?
I did actually watch it, yeah. But I only like Kubrick up to Barry Lyndon. I don't think he did any good work after Barry Lyndon, so I'm not a fan of The Shining or of Full Metal Jacket or of the Emmanuel movie.
Right. Well, it's a relief to meet somebody who has my eyes wide shut, at least, because my mind just boggles.
Everybody knew that was rubbish, right? I mean,
they did, but now they're saying it's his last masterpiece.
That's funny.
It drives me nuts. It really does. I feel so alienated from the world when I hear stuff like that.
But I do think, just think about that run of Dr. Strangelove, 2001, Barry Lyndon. That's something.
I do like Barry Lyndon, I will admit that.
He's beautiful and ironic and clever and, yeah.
And did you see Room 237?
Yeah, I did, but I don't think The Shining is any good anyway, and I don't believe that the Americans take the moon landing.
Oh, okay.
Well, so it doesn't really resonate very much with
me. I actually never liked The Shining until I saw Room 237, and I thought it was because it just other people's fascination began to fascinate me, and that kind of drew me into the movie in a new way.
That's interesting. No, the cult of Kubrick is very interesting, and how you know, like, he can't put a foot wrong, and everything he did has to have these kind of ulterior secret meanings, you know.
And he was very interested in his fans. You know, if you saw that documentary, Kubrick's Boxes, he had a filing system with every fan letter ever written to him, alphabetically, you know, arranged according to where they lived, just in case he ever needed to call on that fan and ask them questions about the cinema in their town. So he actually thought of his fans as his own little workers.
Well, that's very interesting too, because also how interested he was in the cinemas where the film would play, and the quality of the print, and the quality of the sound system, and all of that. He must have had a lot of energy. Admittedly, though, I mean, his films took a very, very long time to make. I mean, perhaps he had a lot of energy, because making it for him was a very relaxed and slow process.
Yeah, a very long time not to make, and sometimes as well.
Yeah, I mean, months and months of production, you know, so a very, very minute page count every day. So he has time to get on the phone and start bugging people in Southampton about the quality of the print of The Killing, you know.
Yeah, I have a theory about Kubrick, but we perhaps won't get into it now. But I thought Room 237 was... It's also interesting as a sort of tie-up point, that because it's a kind of parallel to Rashomon. Now there's five different versions of a single film, and Rashomon, of course, is about five different interpretations of a single event.
Yeah.
So that whole
notion
of the sort of the quantum field experience of reality, or whatever we want to call that, is what you're exploring now. Is that right, with Rashomon, Tombstone?
Yeah, except my stuff's a little bit... I mean, Yeah, but basically, it's basically an event and five different versions of the event, you know, from different people who were participants or who were in the vicinity.
Right. And so this is also tying into the the political question of who writes the history, who writes the official story.
Yeah, yes, that's right. And it's there's that, and also there's approaches to public order. I mean, the most interesting thing for me is how do you actually, you know, what's the best way to approach issues of, like, you know, crowd control and maintaining authority without behaving like a brute.
Right.
It's an interesting issue with which you have to deal if you're in any kind of managerial position at some point.
So
if you're not carrying a gun, you've got to assert authority in a way that achieves the goal without humiliating or upsetting people, you know. And so that's what it's about. That's what my Gunfight at the OK Corral movie is about. How do you assert your authority without humiliating or upsetting people, much less killing them?
So that's a concern for you as a film director, I imagine.
Also. That's my issue. At the moment. Yeah, it's good. It's a good film director issue, too. Film directors should always keep that in mind as well.
Yeah, I can imagine if anything would be in danger of turning into a power trip, it would be that, having the money in
You don't want that to happen. You want it to be a very pleasant exercise where the exercise of power is unobtrusive, you know, and everything moves forward just as it should. Plan for everything to go extremely smoothly.
Right, but at the same time, you're presiding over a series of accidents. Wasn't that Orson Welles' definition of a film director?
That might have been his definition of his role as a film director.
It's definitely not Kubrick's way.
Just create a situation where the actors can do their best work and plan for everything to go extremely smoothly.
Mm.
That's all you have to do.
Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind.
So did you get the green light for yourself on the Rashomon tombstone?
I've greenlit it for myself, yes.
Good. Well, that's good. You wouldn't want
I think I think we have $35,000 raised, maybe if a miracle, you know, comes along, we'll have 65 or 70 to make the film,
right.
And we'll shoot it in May of next year.
And this was all the monkeys built when his work came tumbling down.
That is it for my conversation with Alex Cox. You can find out more about Alex at his blog and website, alexcoxfilms.wordpress.com. Thanks to Matthias for donating this week to the podcast. If you would like to support this podcast, please do so. You can donate at horticulture.com/liminalist or at the blog horticulture.wordpress.com.
Ça prépare mon déco. Ils sont des armes cibles de destruction massive. Came tumbling down. Here comes the monkey.
his boat when his leg came.